Thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Dean. My name's Ian, and I'm an addict. Thanks very much, Angie, for starting that off. If I get close in 40 minutes to carrying the message that you did in 15, I'll be thrilled. That was very, very strong, and it was great to listen. It's great to be here. This is the third meeting in NA was in this building, not here because it's a new building, but underneath the church there was a homeless shelter, and there was this kind of, I think it's possibly where the cafe is now, there's like a crypt thing.
It used to be St Martin's in Philly.
Yeah. And that was the third meeting. Before then, there was two meetings in Chelsea. And if you went to the meeting on Saturday, you had to wait till Thursday for another meeting or go to AA. So when the third meeting came, it was pit stop Mondays in Trafalgar Square. And any meetings in those days, you went to the Saturday meeting, and then when you went to the Monday meeting, exactly the same people who were at the Saturday meeting were at Monday, and the same would be back at Millman Street on Thursday. I can't claim to be a founder. NA was 2 years in existence before I got clean, but I think its growth was exponential, which is a big word for saying it started very slowly and then exploded. And in that early stage, it was shaky growth. You know, meetings would open and fold, people would get clean and use, and it was toddler recovery, and it was the blind leading the blind, and people, you know, finding out new things from the States and wondering what they meant and trying to interpret them, and people would go to conventions and come back with a new idea. Holding hands in meetings never happened until about 3 years. And then somebody came back, well, in America they hold hands, fuck off. Not here. Not for a northerner, anyway. and now they hug. It's funny because you start the meeting with the kind of preambles or whatever. As far as I can remember, it was the same preambles at my first meeting. Got a few things. Try and get to 90 meetings in 90 days. Get a sponsor. What the fuck's a sponsor? Might as well get badges. And try and look at the similarities and not the differences. Well, if you walked into an NA meeting in the early 80s and you didn't have a title, you were definitely looking for the differences, because most of the people in early recovery had come through treatment centres which were, they weren't the National Health, let's put it that way. And so I turned up, and it was the initial nucleus of NA, there was one or two kind of hard cases, but a lot of people who'd come out of these sort of blue chip treatment centres. And it was the nobility of this country, or the children of the nobility of this country. And then the second year the growth came was sort of the very rich North London kind of Jewish kids. And if I'd wanted an excuse to separate myself, there were millions of them. Every person was, I would. And the reality, and that's how I'd lived my life, really, of having differences between people and you know, differences between people made me use, and differences between people stopped me getting clean. I can see that now. I couldn't see it then. And being thrown into that then, and having to just kind of look at another addict at face value, and forget how rich they are, how poor they are, where they come from, what their story is. You know, comparisons would get me back using. It's as simple as that. You know, listening to Angie's story and thinking, well, you know, did I get that low? Was my rock bottom that low? You know, I think the logical career progression for a junkie, the CEO job is death. You know, that's, so by virtue of the fact that I'm here, I didn't have a very low bottom because I'm alive. But apart from that, it was low enough for me to get me here, and I think we all have different thresholds, maybe. I certainly identified with a lot of stuff Angie was saying. I had, towards not the end of my using, towards the end of the breakup of my marriage, which predated, certainly social services were sniffing around my child and the school and were kind of under report, and two parents were chaotic, and you know, there was a lot of interviews, and we just kind of knew everything was getting a bit on top, and we escaped it by sending him off to a friend's in Ireland, because we kind of knew what was coming. So, similarities and differences. Get a sponsor. It took me a while to realise what a sponsor was. I did have a sponsor in my first year, and I think that guy must have been a saint, because what I thought was normal then, and I can look back now, it was sort of living madness. You know, I'd been using drugs, medicating my feelings for so long that I was beyond uncomfortable having a feeling. It was like somebody ripped my skin off, and everything was just sandpaper and acid on my skin. And the huge emotions of kind of jealousy and envy and all of those things. I was, you know, I just couldn't relate to people. There was so much shit going on. And this guy just kind of listened to it, and blah, 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 blah. And he lasted me a year, and we fell out. I became secretary of the fourth NA meeting, which was up in Hampstead. I remember after the meeting once, I was talking to a girl, and my sponsor pulled me to one side and said, "Are you getting friendly with her?" And I said, "Oh, no, she's..." Yeah. And he said, "Well, you go out with her, forget it with me, because, you know, you're just not going to get anywhere, you know, with that." So he had to go. and 4 years later, I emerged from, a very turbulent and painful experience. But it was worth it. I've started doing office duty again. In my early recovery, I have a lot of difficulty relating to people. But I can pretend some of it is shyness, but actually it's self-obsession. That's the root of my shyness, is self-obsession. And at the end of the meeting, you know, what are my choices? Talk to somebody or stack chairs. Yeah, so I was the guy stacking the chairs. You want to get on in the fellowship? Work the steps or join a committee. Much easier. So I became... I was a sort of serial committee person. Used to like to go in at the top. If I had to do a vice chair, I would, but really it was the kind of chairman's positions were the ones that attracted me most. And it was very easy to live in a bubble of pretend kind of status while you were ignoring the steps. And I kept me clean for quite a long time doing that. I was chairman of the NA office. Started the NA convention, became chairman of that. And actually, the whole thing turned into a sort of political quagmire when I was, you know, there was all this lobbying going on, and, you know, you'd ring people up and, you know, so-and-so's going to try and get this through on a vote. Let's see if we can kind of outflank and do this. But, yeah. through the madness, some shit has survived. There's a London convention today. Without that madness and those fights, it wouldn't be there. And actually now, this about a month ago, I've gone back to working as a volunteer in the NA office, which has all got internet and high tech now. So I now sit in my office, and the calls come through to me, and I just have two hours every week when my staff know to leave me alone, and I'm in the meeting room and I just take calls. And this week, I don't know why, it was National Clucking Week this week, I think. Because I had call after call. I'm in bed. I said, "Well, have you thought about getting to a minute? I'm too ill." "If you're going to score, would you get out of bed?" "Yeah, but I can't sleep. I want to get some exercise." what sort of exercise? Go on in. And actually it was quite exhausting, about four of them. And it was great. It was all just this, you know, to-in and fro-in, why they couldn't go to, why they couldn't get to a meeting. And I'm sure going to a meeting wouldn't in itself stop them feeling, but, you know, using wasn't going to help. So, you know, and the shortest way between what they were feeling and feeling better was probably to go to a meeting, because at least they might get some advice or at least somebody to listen to their moaning for a bit and they could go home and moan some more. So that was quite hard, really. My only other call was from a girl who was asking me if I thought it was a good idea as an epileptic that she took cocaine. And I said, well, I have no medical qualifications, but it doesn't sound like a great idea. It's a strange journey is recovery, because I'm starting this talk as me in 2013, but the meat of the story is me 30 years ago, and it's not that I've forgotten that person, but it's just not me anymore. You know, there's threads of me in there, but there's been a lot of change. There had to be a lot of change. First thing you said, 90 meetings in 90 days. Well, me as a newcomer, 30? You settle at 45, maybe? I've done some recovery before, so, you know, 45 is probably 90. Okay. So I did my 90 meetings, and I don't know what it did, but it just meant for 90 days or 90 evenings, I wasn't hanging around with the people I lived with and the people I schooled with. And actually, even though I might not have learnt anything, what I considered at the start of the 90 days was impossible, I realised at the end was possible, that I could actually enjoy, I could do things like go for a coffee and go to the cinema, which just like didn't figure, you know. At the end of my using, I was living in a basement squat, street of dealers. The people around me were dying, getting long prison sentences, and it was just this kind of daily fairground of I don't know, ducking and weaving, and you know, you always thought somebody else was worse than you, and that's kind of what kept me in the game, really. That there's, oh, Junkie John. Now he's a junkie. He's a proper junkie. Not just somebody with a drug habit, which is me. And I think this whole concept of drug addict and addict has probably taken me the best part of 30 years to start to really understand that. Because I've no problems with the concept of me as a drug addict. It's fucking obvious, you know, when you're clucking. But, you know, you hear things, and you hear things again and again and again in meetings, and you actually understand it after about 25 years. Some things you understand 5 years, but... You know, and the stuff keeps coming round again and again and again. I notice these days we don't have slogans. We used to have slogans. Maybe it was a bit of an AA thing, but they used to have these little, you know, take it easy. Yeah. Oh, I'll have a year off, thank you. It was all, I don't know, and bit by bit, I suppose I've learnt more about myself. And perhaps the things that I didn't truly in my heart believe about addiction, the things that I took on trust because I saw that's what I had to do to stay clean, I now sincerely believe are true. But I didn't have to believe they were true to get clean in those early years. In fact, it required very little to stay clean, but just bit by bit, the truth and the reality had, you know, there's a thing they say, more will be revealed. More will be revealed. What the fuck does that mean? More will be revealed. And actually, what's more that's been revealed with me is more of myself has been revealed to myself. I don't think I could have faced the truth about myself when I was first. You know, I was blind to my defects, And I guess they were revealed to me when I was well enough to cope with the fact that, you know, in some ways I was a monster. It's funny, only recently I was listening to somebody's chair and he's explaining about his childhood, and I haven't been to treatment. I had a bit of therapy because I had a major depressive episode, which I'll come to in a minute. So somebody in the fellowship paid for me to have some therapy, so I had that. But I haven't had a lot of analysis. So really what I know about myself is what I've found out through working steps, and particularly the fourth step, and having a sponsor who was a kind of very clear mirror and wouldn't allow me to fudge issues or pretend or get away with anything. And but something that I heard, and I was brought up in a village. I had two sisters. There's two villages. There were only girls and women in my village. Okay, there were some dads. I wasn't like absent dad, but my dad would go to work before I got up. I'd go to bed before he came back, and at the weekend he was a long distance runner. So he'd either be training or running a competition. So my dad was actually some kind of god figure who might appear at Sunday lunchtime and then you wouldn't see him again. But I was in this village, and most of the people in the village I was related to. I have a bit of a convoluted family history. My mother and father are a stepbrother and a sister, so I have this bizarre kind of... So I was this kind of little golden boy in this tiny little village, surrounded by adoring women. And it's the rest of my life's been a bit of a wake-up call. And been quite painful. But I don't know. You know, you hear people saying, "Oh, I knew I was an addict," you know, from the off. I don't know. I knew I was a drug addict. I've always felt a dis-ease. I've always felt a little bit awkward. If that means I'm an addict, I'm an addict. I don't know. I sometimes think everybody feels a bit awkward. I do see kind of some kind of supremely confident kind of people. I think, how the fuck do they do that? You know, my default position is, you know, fear. If you caught me in Afghanistan and you wanted to get some information out of me, I would suggest you put me in a cocktail party. Forget about the electric shocks and all of that. That is my idea of hell. You know, have you come far? from that kind of weird, you know, early recovery, you know, relationships and just the turbulence of everything. This week I've had a guy send me an email on Monday saying he was going to sue me, and two, he was going to report me to the tax authorities because, like a twat, a couple of years ago I was I just built a house and I was a bit short of money, and he said, "Look, this fee's all a bit much. Could I give you a bit of it in cash?" And I went, "Don't usually, but..." Go on then. And this, see you next Tuesday, phoned me up on Monday and threatened to grass me up if I didn't pay him some money. It's blackmail. And going, the old me is going, well, for the amount of money he's asking, I could have his knees done. or I could go and do it myself and save the money. The me years ago would have, you know, I would have had to phone my sponsor, I would have had to go to a meeting. I would have had a week in turmoil, and I would have been talking to people. And there's a thing in I think it's probably in the AA book, not in our book, but there you go, about justifiable resentment. Justifiable resentment is the questionable privilege of the non-addict. As not to say that justifiable resentment is good for normal people either. I don't think it is. But for me, it's justified. This guy's trying to screw me. And I would have bent a million people's ears until I got somebody to agree with me, and then I'd have done whatever I was going to do. Now I just kind of sit down and think, you know what? I did something stupid. Shouldn't have done it. I've opened myself up to somebody who I didn't really know. He's being a twat, but there you go. Dealt with, move on. And that's how life has to be these days. I'm very tuned in, perhaps, to my levels of comfort, what I can handle. You know, I'm not starving to death these days, and certainly in early recovery I wasn't a wealthy person. My squat in Stoke Newington and bicycle kept me clean for a few years, but now things have moved on, and a combination of luck and hard work, life is my problems of a higher class nature these days, but it's still the same stuff. Pride always, when I did my fourth step, and I do it the three columns way or whatever, and I put, jealousy and anger and all of this, and then my sponsor say, and what about pride? And we'll be doing this for a year, and what about pride? And it came into nearly everything I did, and I realised that a lot of how I relate to the world is from some false position of, this is how they should fucking deal with me. And not just accepting, that's just, people have their shit, and it's nothing about me that somebody cut me off in traffic. They're not saying I've got a small willy because they cut me off in traffic. They just wanted to get somewhere a little bit quicker, that's all. But I would take everything personally. Resentment is a poison that you take yourself hoping somebody else will die. That could be the whole of my recovery, that, because the one person who's got in the way of my recovery is me. I came in with so many resentments as to why I wasn't successful and why I hadn't got a car. Well, I couldn't drive, that's one reason I didn't have a car. why I hadn't got a house, why I hadn't got a title. And actually, I was from a charmed generation, really. I was probably the last generation of people who got grammar skills. I was probably the last generation of people who got a student grant. And a student grant for me that came back twice after I'd been arrested, hospitalised, thrown out twice. I don't think that had happened these days. You just, scrappy, end of career. So I was blessed, and although there may have been people in my kind of in those meetings who I could see were more blessed than me, I was blessed, I had a good start in life, and I'm also in England, I'm not starving, I'm not homeless. I have a wife who is needs a little bit more encouragement to appreciate. I don't think a gratitude list is the first of things she does in the morning. She probably does a list of things that would make her life better, which she would like me to buy her. But I have a lot to be grateful for, and probably the poorest person in this room is richer than 90% of the world. That's the truth of it. We're charmed. We live in a country with social services and national health and all of that, and although people moan about it, there is a safety net in this country, which sadly I found out about when I was about 20 years clean. I went through my service Nazi period, and then I thought it was probably time. I'd been bragging in meetings, step a year, that's the way, step a year, and then I got to step four. And after 5 years, and I was still on step four, I stopped talking about step a year. that was back in the dustbin. And I struggled. And I don't know, everyone's experiences of steps is different. But for mine, it's kind of little steps. And then there's step four. It's a beast. It's a massive thing. And actually, for me, a massive part of my recovery came in that period. And they say, this is the one that sorts the men out for the boys. And that's kind of, I'm sure that gets the women out from the girls or whatever. But that was reality for me. Before then, I'd been very mixed up and confused, resentful. And after that, I still can get resentful, but I know I'm doing it now. There's a little voice going, pride. And it changed the world, the way I related to the world. It was a big change. And actually, since then, it's been about practicing what I've found out about myself. The fact that I'm not intrinsically a bad person, I'm just a little bit out of balance in certain areas. And if I indulge those things, it can get pretty bad. And so I did get, you know, I found another sponsor. Find a sponsor who's got what you want. So, yeah, I found a sponsor with a record company, a BMW, a model girlfriend, and a house in Chelsea. And he was a very good sponsor until he found Jesus. And then he gave me the same choice as the last sponsor, actually. He basically said he couldn't sponsor me unless I would kind of join him finding Jesus, and it worked for him. What can I say? I've always had that side of the program is an area of difficulty. It's just a great relief to me to know that there's a concept of something higher, because it's too painful thinking you're the higher thing, because everything's your fault. You know, everything's your success, but everything's your failure. And it's good just to, you know, whether it's one of those things for me that is kind of, I do it because I've seen it work for people and there isn't an option. But do I hand on, I just see it as a very effective technique. And I don't necessarily believe there's somebody listening, but I believe there's a force. There is a force for growth and life and good in the universe, and I can align with that. I can understand that. But it's a difficult area for me, and it's a kind of continuum. But I got to my sort of 20 years or whatever. Everything started getting a bit flat. You know, you come to meetings, and in those days people still smoked in meetings, so I used to use that as an excuse. I've stopped smoking, I can't possibly go to a meeting, you know, so breathing all that secondary. And I had children, and I had a relatively successful business, and all of a sudden the kind of pulls away from meetings were greater than the pulls towards meetings. And when you stop going to meetings a little bit, what I found out was it made you want to go to meetings less. And when you go to meetings less, then it's not long before you're not going to meetings at all. And I went through a year which was, I probably didn't go to a meeting except for two when I was asked to do a chair. And I didn't have the honesty to say to the person who asked me to do the chair, well, actually, I don't think it's really appropriate because I've stopped going to meetings. And I went at that. A chair when you're on a dry drunk like that is fucking painful. It's a horrible experience. Because you know the words, but you just, you know, your heart's not there, really. And it's a horrible experience. For me, a dry drunk is probably, what a dry clean, if you call it. I just got bored with the fellowship. I wasn't bored with the fellowship. I'd stopped working the steps. If you stop working the steps, there's no challenge. You can freewheel in meetings for a while, but then it'll start to annoy you, and then you'll start to find a million other things that are more, you know, money. You know, actually, the only thing that kept me clean for those years was a season ticket at Chelsea in between two people who were smart enough to still go to meetings, and they'd ask me every week, "How are you doing?"
"Fine."
"Do you think you'd be better with me?" "No, why?" But, you know, just kept the door open. And cut a long story short, my great rosy life of success kind of came crashing in a bit. And I'd been through two lots of treatment in recovery for hepatitis. And my business, which had been going great, suddenly wasn't going so great, and everything was you know, and half of it was I was mad. I was arguing with everybody. People don't like paying money to have somebody argue with them. They go somewhere else. So my business was hanging on there. And to be honest, if I'd have had any sense, I'd have just taken the business out and shot it. And it took me 2 years to get from the point of it being terminally ill to not me. I didn't have the courage to take it out and shoot it. It was taken away from me. Somebody else had to make that decision. And actually, it was a fantastic thing. But at the time, all I could see was, I'm going to lose everything. I'm going to lose the wife, the house, the children. How can I go back to meetings? Now I've got nothing. My whole kind of ego thing was tied up with my kind of vision of myself as what I did. I jumped straight over the using. Somehow, something had been drilled into me so much that I was never going to use. But the option was probably less healthy, is I just wanted to kill myself. And I was just obsessed with this. Just, you know, I just don't want to wake up tomorrow. Just don't want to do it. Tried all sorts of things, and then one night I found myself, just night after night, I wouldn't sleep. I'd just be in this kind of pool of sweat, just thinking of all these scenarios about the people who are going to come and break the door down, take this and take that, and, you know, how the children were going to be off somewhere else and all of this. Just persistent negative kind of ruminations, and I just went in the other room, got my dressing gown cord, went out to the front, and there was the railings. I lived in a basement flat. Not squat by that time, but that was a major thing, getting out of the squat. And I realised just kind of before I did anything that I kind of thought I ought to wake the wife up and say things are not as they should be. And she whipped me down to a hospital. And 20 years clean, I was offered a section. And that was it. And the choice was go into the locked ward with some people who possibly might not have been 20 years clean, or accept medication and this kind of nurse practitioner who would come twice a day to give me my pill and then talk to me. And really the discussions would go, how are you today? Not very well. What are you worried about? I'm going to lose everything. Why do you think you're going to lose everything? And there was this constant thing. And this went on for ages and ages and ages. But I kind of knew I didn't want to die. But I just couldn't see where anything was going. And I bumped into somebody who was in recovery. And they just listened and talked and things like that. And he actually gave me some practical advice, in as much as he introduced me to an accountant in recovery. And the guy said, "That's very simple, just fold it, just walk away from it. Just go, yeah. Just ring up your accountant and say, that's it. And that's it, just walk away from it." And eventually, after a lot of arguing, that's what I did. And I remember one day I had to go in the office, I had 12 staff, and I just had to sit down and say, you know, it's over, you're not going to get paid this month. Clear your desk. And that's a horrible, hard thing to do. And I learnt a lesson from that, actually. It would have been a lot kinder to have done it earlier. And now, if I have some bad news, or if I have a difficult decision to make, I just do it. I don't kind of say, oh, I'll do that on Monday. I just go out of the room. I've got some bad shit to do, just do it. Because it never gets better, it just gets bigger. And I realised that the kind of where my strength had come in the past was from meetings. That's the only place it had come from. I really didn't want to go back to NA. My imagined persona in NA was so puffed up with fucking vice chair of this and all that bollocks. So I went to weird lunchtime AA meetings tucked away in funny little places where nobody knew me, and sat crying at the back for about a month. And then my friend dragged me along to an NA meeting. People were just thrilled to see me back. It was just all this kind of projection of judgment. I'm the judge. I'm, you know, I only feel I'm judged because I judge. You know, there was no judgment. People were so kind, so welcoming to have me back. Because I understand it. When people come back, it reinforces my recovery. It's more of a threat when they're out there. Because I kind of think, they're out there, they're not dead. Maybe I could be. But if they come back in, for me, that is... You know, and I can see that now. But then... So I went back in. I got a home group. I got a commitment that didn't involve a uniform tea person. Also involved me talking to people. So I know that if you ever see me not volunteering to pick chairs up, it's not because I'm lazy, it's because I'm trying to force myself to say hello to somebody or kind of engage with now rather than hide behind something. Life is pretty good at the moment. I've had a busy week. I've got my house is in some sort of open house thing over the weekend, so I'm probably going to have about 1,500 nosy grannies through my house on Sunday. And I don't know. It took a lot of recovery and a lot of meetings for me just to stop ruining my life. That's a simple thing. I could have done it myself at any time, but I couldn't. I just couldn't. I could only do it by listening to people again and again and again. And I'm still hearing new things now that I've probably heard a million times before, but they've never got through. I have never, you know, I see people who work really hard in the fellowship, and hats off to them, and I kind of wish I could be like you. My little kind of aside about trying to haggle on the 90 meets, that's my life. You know, I cheat in exams, I try and find shortcuts, the easier way. That's the way I would naturally take. And NA is the only thing I've ever been involved with. There are no shortcuts. The shortcuts bite you on the arse. Might not be this year, might be 10 years, in my case it was 20 years, but it gets you in the end. That's not to say you've got to go out of here and work, you know, the steps. Just stay clean. Turn up at meetings, keep your ears open, and just try and be honest. Just try and, you know, take something from every meeting, a tiny thing, and eventually it'll all piece together to a jigsaw of, in my experience, of a self-knowledge that's actually allowed me to have a life that I enjoy. Thanks. Thank you.